This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel, Stone Mountain, in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Isaiah. And now here's Pastor Sandy as he teaches through the book of Isaiah, chapters 13 and 14.
You read in Revelation of the global cataclysms that will take place and the massive death tolls that will follow in their wake. You know, a quarter of the world will be destroyed. A third of the world's population will be destroyed. We're talking billions of people will die in these last days' judgments. God is going to shake the heavens. And more than that, he's going to shake the earth. It'll be moved out of its place, he says, by the wrath of the Lord of hosts in the day of his fierce anger. Over the years, in all of my trips to California, I've only experienced one earthquake. But that one was enough. Mac and I, we were in the upper deck at Anaheim Stadium watching the Angels game when all of a sudden my seat started to shake and the foul pole in front of me started to shake and everything started to shake. Woo! Turns out the epicenter of the 5.7 quake was south of San Diego, down near the Mexican border. We felt it as far away as Anaheim, 100 miles away. But it was a moving experience. It was serious, not for the locals. It was just a 5.7, but for Mac and I, it was something to remember. And yet the day is coming when God will shake not only California, he's going to shake the earth off its foundations. He'll even shake the heavens above. As Jerry Lee Lewis sang, there's a whole lot of shaking going on. Verse 14, it shall be as the hunted gazelle and as a sheep that no man takes up, every man will turn to his own people and everyone will flee to his own land. Would you pay close attention to the language there in verse 14? The subtlety probably escaped the Jews of old, but not those of us who have the benefit of a New Testament. For notice the people who live through God's final judgments on planet Earth are referred to, and I quote, as a sheep that no one takes up. Did you see that? That implies that some sheep do get taken up. Throughout the New Testament, we're taught that before God's judgment comes down, God's church, Christ's church, is going to go up. It's called the rapture. Jesus will descend in the clouds and snatch us to heaven. Critics of the rapture say that the doctrine never appeared in the Old Testament, but I beg your pardon. Here it is. Verse 15, everyone who is found will be thrust through, and everyone who is captured will fall by the sword. Their children also will be dashed to pieces before their eyes. Their houses will be plundered and their wives ravished. Behold, I stir up the Medes against them, who will not regard silver, and as for gold, they will not delight in it. Here Isaiah mentions the Medes. Apparently, the Medes were motivated by revenge more so than gold. And this may speak of the aftermath of Babylon's fall in 539 BC, or it could refer to the modern day Medes. And who might they be? How about the Kurds? The Kurds, the Kurdish people, are the ethnic group that served as Saddam Hussein's whipping boy in the 1980s, and they're now the object of the wrath and hate of the new Islamic State, ISIS. Remember, Saddam experimented with his weapons of mass destruction on the Kurds. He gassed innocent men, women, and children. Kurdish vengeance and anger may still be taken out on a future Babylonian king. That's what Isaiah sees here. Notice verse 18. Also their bows will dash the young men to pieces, and they will have no pity on the fruit of the womb. Their eye will not spare children. Our translation uses bows, but the Hebrew word kesef is literally launcher, possibly modern missile launchers. Verse 19, and Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldeans' pride, will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. You remember Genesis 19 records Sodom's destruction, and I quote, "The Lord rained brimstone and fire on Sodom and Gomorrah out of the heavens." And apparently Babylon will be destroyed in a blazing inferno. But again, this doesn't relate to ancient Babylon. Remember, it was conquered without firing a shot. The city was taken by the Medes and the Persians intact. I believe this fire raining from heaven is reserved for a future Babylon. In fact, Revelation 17 and 18 speaks of a future Babylon. Either ancient Babylon will be rebuilt where it was torn down, or the Babylonian system of religion will become so identified with one city that it takes its name. But John sees this future Babylon. She becomes the world center for business and religion. And yet we're told in Revelation 18, verse 19, in 1 hour, she is made desolate. He reports that the nations will mourn when they see the smoke of her burning. Once again, she'll be destroyed, as was Sodom and Gomorrah. I believe what Isaiah sees, this Babylonian overthrow, like Sodom, is a future city that will rise in the last days. Now notice verse 20 adds, "And it will never be inhabited, nor will it be settled from generation to generation, nor will the Arabian pitch tents there, nor will the shepherds make their sheepfolds there. But wild beasts of the desert will lie there, and their houses will be full of owls. Ostriches will dwell there, and wild goats will caper there." This once mighty city will be abandoned and lie in ruins. It'll be uninhabited by anyone other than wild desert animals. Not even the Arabians will pitch their tents there. I wonder what will keep them away. Could it be radiation fallout? He says, "The hyenas will howl in their citadels and jackals in their pleasant palaces. Her time is near to come and her days will not be prolonged." Again, these last verses here of chapter 13 depict an abandoned Babylon, a fact not true of ancient Babylon. After being conquered by the Medo-Persians in 539 BC, the city remained vital for centuries. In fact, 200 years later, Alexander the Great made the city of Babylon his capital. Again, Isaiah's prophecy is yet for the future. This is why the former Iraqi ruler Saddam Hussein, when he made his attempts to reconstruct Babylon, this is why it drew so much attention from Bible scholars. Did you realize that in the desert, 62 miles south of Baghdad, Saddam Hussein spent $25 million rebuilding ancient Babylon, or at least starting? He styled himself as the next Nebuchadnezzar. He wanted Babylon to be his capital. In fact, many of our American troops walked the halls of Saddam's 500-room palace. He rebuilt Babylon's Marduk Gate and several other ceremonial buildings. He had plans to reproduce the Hanging Gardens and even the infamous Tower of Babel. Obviously, his plans were cut short. But who knows if a future Middle East leader won't revive this vision of a new Babylon. With all the oil money flowing into the region, the means exist for a Dubai-type construction project. Babylon may well rise from the ashes again. It's interesting, when Isaiah first uttered this prophecy, Babylon was just a local city on the Euphrates River. It took 100 years in the overthrow of Assyria for Babylon to become a world empire. The thought of Babylon as a superpower sounded as strange to Isaiah's contemporaries as the idea of a present-day Babylon becoming a strategic city again is as strange to our ears. But in the decades to come, I challenge you, keep your eye on Babylon. I believe there's a good chance that the ancient city will reemerge as an economic and as a commercial center. Well, chapter 14 begins. "For the Lord will have mercy on Jacob and will still choose Israel and settle them in their own land. The strangers will be joined with them and they will cling to the house of Jacob." The Lord will have mercy on Jacob and will still choose Israel. The judgment that comes on Babylon occurs when Israel is resettled in their own land. And here's another prophecy that points to the end, to the future, even to our day. When the Jews return home, Isaiah says, strangers will join them. Notice, Then people will take them and bring them to their place, and the house of Israel will possess them for servants and maids in the land of the Lord. They will take them captive, whose captives they were, and rule over their oppressors. God will turn the tables on ancient Babylon. Remember, for 70 years, Daniel and Ezekiel and their fellow Jews were exiles in Babylon. But when God overthrows Babel, the Babylonians will serve the Jews. He goes on, and it shall come to pass in the day that the Lord gives you rest from your sorrow and from your fear and the hard bondage in which you were made to serve, that you will take up this proverb against the king of Babylon and say, how the oppressor has ceased, the golden city ceased. The Lord has broken the staff of the wicked, the scepter of the rulers. He who struck the people in wrath with a continual stroke, he who ruled the nations in anger, is persecuted, and no one hinders. In other words, the Babylonian king is going to taste some of his own medicine. Like Saddam Hussein, he'll be humbled. You know, chapter 13 is God's judgment on the city of Babylon. But now chapter 14 points a finger at Babylon's king. Historically, at the time of Babylon's fall to the Medes and the Persians, King Belshazzar ruled over Babel. But the spiritual king of Babel is someone far more sinister. Notice we're told the whole earth is at rest and quiet. They break forth into singing. Indeed, the cypress trees rejoice over you and the cedars of Lebanon saying, since you were cut down, no woodsman has come up against us. Remember, the book of Isaiah was written 100 years before the Jews were taken into captivity to Babylon. God used King Nebuchadnezzar to judge his people. But during their captivity, these words of Isaiah provided them hope. The Jews were assured that one day God would turn the tables on the Babylonians. He would cut down their oppressors. They held on to these words of Isaiah. These prophecies encourage the exiled Jews. And where there's hope, even the worst circumstances can be endured. It's been said, when hope is alive, the night is less dark, the solitude is less deep, and the fear is less acute. Where there's hope. In 1965, Navy pilot James Stockdale was shot down over the jungles of Vietnam. For 7 years, he was held prisoner by the Viet Cong in the Hanoi Hilton, in the jail, in the infamous prison there. He was frequently beaten and tortured and isolated from others. At times, he went weeks with his hands chained over his head. He couldn't even swat the swarming mosquitoes. He ended up permanently impaired by his ordeal. When he was finally released, he was asked, how in the world did you endure such horrible torture, such horrible brutality for so many years? And this is what he answered. Hope kept me alive. The hope of one day going home, that each day could be the day of my release. Hope is a powerful entity. I've heard it said a man can live 40 days without food, 3 days without water, 8 minutes without air, but he cannot live 1 second without hope. We need hope. And this is why biblical prophecy was written. This is what biblical prophecy is all about. It was written to folks who were in the middle of the battle, who were caught between good and evil, God and Satan. That's you and I. And yet, prophecy fast forwards to the end of time, to the final battle, to the day of the Lord, and it reveals the victor. And it says to us, if we'll stand with Jesus now, we'll win in the end. We're on the winning team. If we stand with Jesus now, we'll win in the end. God will work all things together for our good and for His glory. Verse 9 speaks directly to the king of Babylon. Hail from beneath is excited about you, to meet you at your coming. It stirs up the dead for all the chief ones of the earth. It has raised up from their thrones all the kings of the nations. Wow. How would you like to somebody to say, hey, hail's going to be excited about you, buddy. Hail's going to be there to welcome you. All the kings are going to be wrestled up. They're all going to be waiting for you when you arrive. Belshazzar was the Babylonian king who mocked God by bringing out God's sacred vessels and filling them with wine and whiskey. He used the holy saucers and bowls to toast the idols of Babylon. It was blasphemy against the true God. And now Isaiah sends Belshazzar an invitation to hell. He says, hell is eager to welcome you. It looks forward to your arrival. All its inhabitants will come out to see you. And then verse 10 records his reception. They all shall speak and say to you, have you also become as weak as we? Have you become like us? Hell humbles its former kings, its arrogant men, and it'll do the same to Belshazzar. Your pomp is brought down to Sheol. That's Hebrew for hell. And the sound of your stringed instruments, the maggot, is spread under you, and worms cover you. Welcome to hell, buddy. Notice here what Isaiah teaches us about hell. First, apparently people are conscious in hell. They're very much aware of their condition and their surroundings. They speak, they see, they have thoughts, they have feelings. Second, hell's inhabitants recognize each other. Here are the former kings of the earth. They know the king of Babylon when they see him. Apparently they know each other in hell. Third, they mock each other. Hell is full of sarcasm. Talk about bullies. They're all over the place in hell. Its residents sneer at the king of Babylon. Have you become as weak as we? It's a spiteful place. Hell is a spiteful place. And then fourth, hell's inhabitants are subject to great pain. Here they're lying on maggots and covered in worms. You know what a maggot is, don't you? A maggot is a slug-like, worm-like parasite. It has a mouth hook that tears into its food and literally rips it apart. Whenever my wife, I never heard this expression before I married my wife, but whenever my wife gets really repulsed, she always shouts out, "Gag a maggot! Gag a maggot!" You know why she says that? It's because maggots don't easily gag. Maggots eat everything. If you gag a maggot, that's repulsive. In Mark chapter 9, when Jesus warns us of hell, he mentions three times in Mark 9, their worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. Hey, if you like lying down on a gas grill while worms and maggots crawl all over your body, then hell is your kind of place. That's what the hell's going to be like. In summer of 2010, a shocking event occurred on a United States Airways flight leaving Atlanta. Someone brought on board a container of rotted meat filled with maggots. As the plane taxied to the runway, maggots started falling out of the overhead bins, creating quite a disturbance on the plane. One passenger said, "It only takes one maggot to upset your world." I suppose so. The plane was immediately turned around and it was returned to the gate. But when you take your seat in hell, you're going to be sitting in a bed of maggots. I'm just telling you what it says. Plump red wigglers will be crawling all over your body. Hell must smell like a bait shop. If you don't like maggots, here's another reason to give your life to Jesus. Unlike U.S. Air, hell isn't going to stop for a few maggots. And a maggot shower is just one of the tortures of hell. You remember Luke chapter 16 tells us that hell is a forever fire. It's forever on fire. It's like what Moses saw on Mount Sinai. You remember he saw the bush, the burning bush. The bush burned, but it wasn't consumed. Its torment, its inferno was eternal. This is what hell will be like. It will burn continually, but never die out. Your throat will always be parched. Your thirst will never be quenched. In Dante's Inferno, he writes an inscription over the gate of hell, "All hope abandoned, you who enter here." We talked about how we all need hope. The worst part of hell is that there will be no hope. It's been said, even hell is truth known too late. The reality of a literal, eternal, infernal hell should shake us all out of our apathy. That we don't go there and that the people we love don't go there. Several years ago, I read a Gallup poll that revealed 60% of Americans believed in hell, in a literal hell. But here was the kicker. Only 4% of Americans thought they were going there. 60% believed in it, but only 4% thought they were headed there. Let me ask you, what's the basis of your hope? Some folks trust in the fact that they're a good person, or that they try real hard, or that they mean well. They're hoping that God grades on the curve. A.W. Tozer once wrote, "The vague and tenuous hope that God is too kind to punish the ungodly has become a deadly opiate for the consciences of millions." Other people hedge their bets. They've bought into some religious dogma. And yet, let me tell you what the Bible says. If you're trusting in anyone or anything other than the finished work of Jesus Christ, you're going to hell. Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." God has made one way to heaven, and that's through his Son Jesus. Realize, God's one and only provision for sin is the shed blood of his Son Jesus. Therefore, if you reject his blood, if you reject Jesus, then you are signing your ticket to hell. There's no other way to get to heaven but through Jesus. Verse 12 continues to address the king of Babylon. "How you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning. How you are cut down to the ground, you who weakened the nations." Now recall, biblical prophecy is fond of twin fulfillments. Remember, prophecy comes in pairs, in twins. Up until this point, Isaiah 14 has spoken of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. But Belshazzar was only a puppet on a string. Far more sinister was the force behind the marionette. For a spiritual king had propped up the earthly ruler. In Daniel chapter 10, an angel was dispatched to Daniel with a message. When he arrived, he said that he had been detained by the prince of Persia, a demon, a fallen angel. It's interesting, on occasion, demons empower and they inspire the kings of this world, so much so that there was a demon, a prince of Persia. There was a demon assigned to Persia. And this was also true of Babylon. If Babylon is the seat of Satan on the earth, then who do you think is the king of Babylon? Well, no doubt, it's Satan himself. Here Isaiah sees past the human kings of Babylon to the power that had motivated them and had inspired them. This is also what happens in other prophecies. In Ezekiel 28, there Ezekiel is describing the king of Tyre when all of a sudden the Holy Spirit shifts the conversation to Satan, who was the power behind Tyre. And notice here how Isaiah refers to Satan, to the devil himself. He calls him, "O Lucifer, son of the morning." Realize, Satan didn't begin as the epitome of evil. Ezekiel chapter 28, verse 14 says that he was once, and I quote, "the anointed cherub who covers." He was an angel, and a special one at that. One who actually covered. He was the anointed cherub who covered, perhaps, the throne of God. From March the 10th to the 23rd, I'll be leading a tour to Israel, and we would love for any of our listeners to join us. We'll start at the magnificent theater on the Mediterranean where Paul preached to King Agrippa, and we'll end with worship and communion at the Garden Tomb. In between, it's one exciting adventure after another. Imagine relaxing by the Sea of Galilee one day and floating on the Dead Sea the next, exploring waterfalls in the Golan Heights, and admiring the desert from the top of Masada. We'll spend time in the rock city of Petra and in the holy city of Jerusalem. We'll ride camels, wade through Hezekiah's tunnel, boat across the Sea of Galilee, and study God's word at every turn. Hey, a trip to Israel is like a Bible study on steroids. If you've never been, I encourage you to go. And if you like, you can go with us. Our trip is affordably priced. If you'd like more details, please contact us. Here's Josh to give you that information.
Thanks, Pastor Sandy. Yes, to learn more about this exciting trip, visit sandyadams.org. Again, this amazing trip is taking place March 10th through the 23rd, 2019. We encourage you to contact the church office at Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain. You can call us at 770-736-2828 or log on to sandyadams.org. On behalf of Pastor Sandy and the entire production team, it's our prayer that you would seek the Lord about joining Pastor Sandy in Israel in March of 2019.